Good morning. I'm grateful to the organizers for giving me a chance to talk to you this morning as part of your spintronics program. My name is Chris van der Waal. I'm a professor here in the materials department. I've been at UCSB for less than 2 years at this point. I previously worked in industrial labs, mainly at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, where I have done a wide variety of first principles calculations on materials, mostly semiconductors, defects, surfaces, interfaces. I'm going to start out with a disclaimer. I'm not an expert in magnetism or spintronics. However, I do know a couple of things about zinc oxide, and since zinc oxide recently has been in the news as a very promising material as a host for magnetic impurities, and lots of interesting things in that respect have been published, we thought it might be interesting for you to kind of hear about our ongoing work on zinc oxide, what we're learning, what some of the misconceptions are that we think exist about the material, and maybe that might actually be useful in terms of the spintronics field as well. I always start out with acknowledgements. The main person I want to acknowledge is Anderson Giannotti, who's an assistant project scientist in my group here. And he's been doing most of the calculations that I will be reporting on that we've been doing in the past 2 years. Other people that I want to single out are Jörg Neugebauer and Catherine Stampfel, who were previously postdocs with me, as well as Sukit Limpid-Jumnong, actually. And they've all gone back to their home countries to very nice positions there. We also have active interactions with a number of experimentalists, just to kind of keep us honest and to make sure that what we are doing is relevant. So as an introduction, let me say a little bit about zinc oxide, because as I said, zinc oxide has been in the news, not just because of spintronics, but because of a wide variety of novel applications that the material is being used for. Now, the material itself is obviously not novel. People have been using zinc oxide for probably 100 years in various applications. It's one of the most widely used semiconductors because metal oxides are used in varistors, which essentially occur in all of the surge protectors that we have in these little power strips that protect our PCs from voltage surges. So that's a very widely used application that's based on polycrystalline material. You also know, of course, that zinc oxide is piezoelectric, so that opens up all kinds of applications in transducers, and it's actually an aspect that people flag as making it a very interesting material for multifunctional materials where various properties are combined. Later on, I'll say a little bit more about this aspect of radiation hardness. It turns out that when exposed to a radiation environment, very few defects are generated in zinc oxide, which of course is useful for applications like putting electronic components in space. And we have some thoughts about why that might be. And as I already said, of course, zinc oxide is a good host for magnetic impurities. From a chemistry point of view, zinc oxide can be used for catalysis and also for sensors. The surface properties of zinc oxide, which I really won't go into in this talk, but they are quite fascinating, and actually they are very useful because the surface conductivity of zinc oxide turns out to be very, very sensitive to the presence of adsorbates. And for instance, it can be used for alcohol sensors that are used in breathalyzers. Now, the mechanism for that conductivity, interestingly, is far from understood. People know it's there, but there have been lots of hypotheses about how it comes about and how the interaction with the adsorbates actually changes it. But it's really quite an open field in terms of understanding the mechanisms. A lot of excitement has been generated in the area of nanostructures based on zinc oxide. It turns out that it's fairly straightforward to grow nanocrystals as well as nanowires. So these are wires that have a diameter of maybe as little as 10 nanometers, but they can be microns long. And of course, that has generated a lot of excitement. Could be very useful for sensors because you get a huge surface area. People have talked about field emitters and also about light emitters because, again, actually coupling out light from a structure like that could be a lot more efficient than doing it from a traditional LED sort of structure.
That's wurtzite structure.
The zinc oxide structure is wurtzite, yes. So the light emission brings me to the last thing, and for our purposes here at UCSB, probably the most important aspect, namely that of optoelectronics. Zinc oxide has a direct band gap of 3.4 electron volts. That's essentially the same as that of gallium nitride. And I'm sure you know that gallium nitride in the past 10 or 15 years has really had a remarkable surge in applications, mainly thanks due to Professor Suji Nakamura, who's a professor here. He essentially developed the technology that enables the use of gallium nitride for light-emitting diodes, as we see them in traffic lights. We'll see them increasingly in displays. We will see them in solid-state lighting applications. And because of the similarity of band gap, as well as other properties of zinc oxide to gallium nitride, there is actually a lot of interest in seeing whether zinc oxide could play a role in some of the same applications. Now, initially, that was limited to one aspect where people thought about using zinc oxide as a substrate for gallium nitride growth. And that interest arose from the fact that gallium nitride, which, as I said, is a very exciting material, has one important drawback, namely that bulk crystals of gallium nitride are exceedingly difficult to grow. People can do it, but they come up with like millimeter-sized crystals of no use for technological applications. And of course, that is a major damper on the technological applications because it means that anytime you want to grow gallium nitride devices, you have to grow them on some other substrate, sapphire, silicon carbide. You get lots of extended defects, and that limits the efficiency of the devices and causes all kinds of problems. In the case of zinc oxide, bulk substrates, bulk single crystals are available commercially. You can buy them. And so initially people thought, well, that's great. Let's grow gallium nitride on top of zinc oxide. And some people are doing this. But then the thought, of course, arose, well, why not use zinc oxide itself as the optoelectronic material? Zinc oxide actually has another advantage over gallium nitride. That etching of the material to produce devices is readily possible, whereas, again, in gallium nitride, that's very difficult. So in this area of optoelectronics, another interesting aspect of zinc oxide is that it has a huge excitonic binding energy, much larger, in fact, than that of gallium nitride. And again, some people think that specifically for lasers, that might lead to new mechanisms of lasing that could be extremely efficient. So actually, lasing and light emission in general has definitely been demonstrated already in zinc oxide, but only based so far on optical pumping. Of course, what you really want to accomplish in an optoelectronic device is that you can do it by injection of carriers. And the groundwork for that has been performed already. You need to be able to make heterojunctions. But more importantly, or equally importantly, you need to be able to control the doping of the material. Anytime you talk about injecting carriers, you need to inject electrons as well as holes, and that's actually where the weakness is right now. In particular, zinc oxide, along with a number of other oxides, I should say. So a lot of what I'm saying here today can actually be generalized to a number of other oxides. It has the problem that when the material is grown, it typically has a very high electron concentration. It is highly n-type. And the cause of this has been widely debated. The traditional, conventional explanation is that it is due to oxygen vacancies. So in a schematic ball and stick model, this is the oxygen. If you create a vacancy on that site, it behaves as a donor. I'll have more to say about that later. And the traditional view is that the material is always oxygen poor. A lot of these vacancies are unintentionally present, and they cause n-type conductivity. Okay, that's the conventional view. The evidence supporting this is very, very meager, in my opinion. There are very few papers in the literature that actually even attempt to come up with any sort of assessment of actual vacancy concentrations, identification of the vacancy in the material, etc. So we thought that this was an excellent problem to try and tackle from a first principles point of view, and look at the oxygen vacancies as well as a whole host of other point defects in great detail. And then, of course, the ultimate goal is, once we understand the n-type problem in more detail, to move on and see whether it will actually be possible to also make p-type material.
Whether the presence of this vacancy is accompanied by something like F-centers in alkali light, where haloid vacancies produce F-centers and absorption in the visible part of the spectrum, maybe here in infrared and so on.
Yes.
So it would be the way of detecting such vacancies.
Yes, absolutely. And I will, in a few minutes, talk about experiments that do exactly that. So the approach that we are using in our first principles calculations is to do density functional theory and in a formalism that I'll show right here, where if we want to assess the properties of a point defect, probably the key property is its formation energy. How much energy does it cost to create that? And I will show you that actually along the way, that also produces all of the necessary information about the electronic behavior of the point defect. So first of all, once you know the formation energy, at least when you're close to equilibrium, you also immediately know the concentration. So that is a handy way for kind of screening defects and saying, well, if they have high formation energy, it's very unlikely that they will actually occur in the material. And only defects with low formation energy will actually play a role in the properties. So then the next question is, how do we define this formation energy? Well, we do a calculation for a chunk of the crystal in which an oxygen vacancy has been removed. When I say a chunk of the crystal, technically we use the supercell approach, where a portion of the crystal is periodically repeated. We compare the energy of that system with the defect with the energy of the perfect bulk. And then we need to take two additional things into account, namely, where does that oxygen atom go? Thermodynamically, it goes to a reservoir, the energy of which is the oxygen chemical potential. And the other aspect, as I mentioned in the context of the electronic behavior, is that if this oxygen vacancy behaves as a donor, it gives up a certain number of electrons. In this example, it gives up 2 electrons. Those electrons go into a reservoir, the energy of which is the electron chemical potential, or in other words, the Fermi level. And that's why for a defect in its positive charge state, we have this linear dependence on the Fermi level with a factor of 2. As I said, we calculate these properties based on density functional theory, supercell geometry, etc. And actually, a number of other people have already done this in the past 5 years or so, coming up with results that are qualitatively similar, but quantitatively don't quite agree with each other. And we think that a major problem in this is that density functional theory, which is kind of the workhorse for doing calculations for materials these days, has some problems in dealing with zinc oxide. The first thing that we wanted to do was to kind of try and develop an approach for overcoming those deficiencies. So what am I talking about when I talk about deficiencies? Particularly, I'm talking about the role of the D states in the zinc atom. The D states, in principle, in an ideal world, you would want to ignore them. We use a pseudo-potential approach in the calculations, and in principle, we would like to say, well, the 3D states of zinc are core states, and we're not going to worry about them. Unfortunately, in a material like zinc oxide, you can't do that. Those D states essentially overlap with the valence band, which is largely made up out of oxygen P states. Particularly the top of the valence band has a character that is mostly oxygen P states. And since those D states are only about 8 electron volts below the valence band maximum, there is actually significant hybridization interaction going on. And in a simple kind of perturbation theory picture, you could say that when these D states are explicitly included, there is a repulsion with the P states at the top of the valence band. So these D states push up the top of the valence band. And that's an important effect that explicitly shows up in the electronic structure. And particularly, if you want to calculate properties like band alignments, deformation potentials, anything having to do with electronic levels of defects, etc., the presence of these D states really does make a difference. So, of course, then we say, well, we can't just treat them as core electrons, we treat them as valence electrons, we just include them in the calculation. However, the problem is that when you do density functional calculations in the local density approximation or in the generalized gradient approximation, the binding energy of these D states is underestimated. So this problem has been realized for a long time, and particularly actually for people who've been doing calculations on magnetic systems or other oxides, this has been recognized for almost 20 years now, and it really shows up also in the case of this semiconductor, where if the D states are underbound, they are too close to the top of the valence band, this PD repulsion is too strong in the perturbation theory picture, and that means that the valence band will be pushed up too much, essentially an artifact, and that means that a lot of these properties that we're calculating will be negatively affected by this deficiency. So, by the way, kind of the simplistic way, the pragmatic way of thinking about this problem is that the electrons that reside in these D states are a lot more localized than the electrons that make up the extended states for the valence and conduction bands. And for extended states, the local density approximation works very, very well. For these more localized states, it really doesn't work as well, and it's that discrepancy in the accuracy of the description that really causes this problem. Yep.
The DFTs, I mean, even for material where you don't have these states, the DFT is not really that anyway.
Yes.
So this is above and beyond what that normal, the normal band gap underestimation.
Exactly. The normal band gap problem, which has to do with the discontinuity and the exchange and correlation potential, that's still there. It's a totally different problem, but, well, I don't have time to go into this, but actually what I'm going to present to you also helps us overcome that problem, it turns out.
Yeah, but that's discontinuity is out of the FT, so it's not a problem of the FT, it's a problem of the LDA. Yeah. Just to be clear, mm-hmm. that before you fix the problem, identify the origin.
Okay, which? The discontinuity problem? Yeah, oh, okay, yeah, I agree with you, thank you.
But the other thing I didn't quite understand, you actually said it's the hybridization that you don't get it right, or it's just the position of the field?
It's the position that you don't get right. Yeah. The hybridization works fine.
It's not the coupling
itself. No, if we find a way of correcting the positions of the D states, then everything else should be fine. And we think it is. So the approach that a number of people before us have been taking to try and correct for this is to add so-called U parameter to the description within LDA and come up with the so-called LDA plus U approach. This has been done almost 10 years ago already, has been mostly applied to systems that have partially filled these shells, again, the magnetic systems that I was alluding to, where kind of the most well-known application and implementation of this is that by introducing this U parameter, the filled states move down in energy, the unoccupied states move up in energy.
U is something like Hubbard parameter.
Yes, exactly. So we figured that even though we have...
That U by first principle or just
what we do is it's actually rather difficult to extract U directly from the calculation for the solid. So what our approach is we calculate U for an atom, and then we screen it by applying the optical dielectric constant. This is an approximation, clearly. This is not a perfect way of doing things, but it gives us a prescription that we rigorously follow so that we can treat the number of materials in a consistent fashion. It just allows us to overcome this problem that we've seen in the literature that, well, when people do the LDA plus U, very often they kind of just publish a range of possible results depending on the value of U, and then you don't really know what to choose. So at least we have a consistent prescription here.
Maybe naive question. What actually this range of energy means? That's inside the conduction band?
Well, it would depend on the material that you're looking at.
Apply to zinc oxide.
In the case of zinc oxide, actually, what I'm trying to show here is the density of states associated with the D states. Okay.
The D states. Which are eight electron volts down.
Yeah. So the.
What kind of Fermi energy?
Well, the particular.
The energy is 10 electron volts or 12 electron volts above the D states.
Right. So in this, I'm kind of mixing pictures here, and I'm sorry for that. This picture would be more appropriate in the case of partially filled D states. Okay. In the case of the completely filled D state, the Fermi level in our zinc oxide material is obviously somewhere within the band gap of the material. Okay. So it doesn't overlap with the D states at all. But the part of this picture that does apply is that by introducing the U parameter, we shift the D states, all of the D states, they're all occupied, we shift them down in energy. Okay, and that's exactly the effect that we want to accomplish to overcome the deficiency in LDA. Yes?
Just to summarize, so that I understand what's going on, you're actually not splitting the D states at all.
No.
You do a more shift.
Yes.
So it could be a new, or could just be a shift in the single particle energies, because the LPA is not represented correctly.
Yes.
You shift it into a place.
Yes. Now, you touch upon a very interesting issue that we have thought about quite a bit. To what extent are the corrections that we are applying similar to what you would do, for instance, if you would do a self-interaction correction? Okay, and it's really
an equivalent way of looking at it,
ultimately. I mean, as you say, we shift the a particular set of states to kind of overcome a deficiency in the LDA, and you could probably equally well do that within self-interaction correction format as well. Yeah. Yes, then it would be different. But for the filled states, it's well, we don't have a rigorous proof for this, but we think that the description is really equivalent. We've chosen the LDA plus U because it happens to be a formalism that has been developed in quite a bit of detail already, and so we didn't need to reinvent the wheel, and it works very well within the context of this particular material. So we, as I said, we determined the U from a first principles calculation for atoms. We then apply it to zinc oxide. We've actually applied it in the meantime to a wide range of materials. I don't have time to show you the results. But the bottom line is that we do get a significant improvement in all of the properties that I was mentioning to you previously, that otherwise, if you just do LDA, you don't really get very well. In addition, because we move the D states down, we reduce the repulsion between the D states and the top of the valence band. We move the valence band down, we increase the band gap. Okay. Now, that increase in the band gap is only a modest correction to the band gap error, because as we know, there should still be a significant band gap error because of the remaining problems. However, what we have done, and I didn't want to take the time to go into the details of this here, but since we now essentially have two data points, we have one set of calculations in LDA, which gives us a specific band gap. We have another set of calculations within LDA plus U that yields a different band gap. There is information in there about how properties of the material, in particular properties of defects, change when you change the band gap. And we use that information essentially to extrapolate to the experimental values. So when I'm going to present the results to you next, those results will show a band gap that's essentially the experimental band gap. And the way we can do this is by using this extrapolation procedure that allows us to approximately predict what the properties of defects are going to be when the band gap would actually have its experimental value. Yes?
You're trying to avoid going into that, but I can't resist asking. How does that differ from just setting U to the value which will then give you the experimental band gap?
It's very, very different. And if you would set U to a value that gives you the experimental band gap, first of all, I think you're doing something that's very unphysical. Because you, I mean, some people have done this actually, and we really think it's an inappropriate thing to do, because you vastly overestimate U by doing that, since there is no reason why. I mean, it's what we talked about, right? It's correction to the states is separate from the normal band gap problem, and you can't expect U to fix the usual band gap problem. So you would overestimate U, and you actually get very bad agreement with experiments for a whole host of properties. Even the lattice constant, if I remember correctly, becomes very, very poor if you would use that large a value of U. So,
the question one is that, are you going to tell us about exactly how you extrapolate and what you mean by extrapolate?
Well, okay, I didn't include the slide in this talk because I was told I only had 20 minutes. And I think we have... feel free to leave at any time, by the way. It's different because we think we have a consistent way of determining U. It's an approximate way, okay? It's based on this atomic calculation. But we think that the value that we determine and that we use to shift the D states, we think that that is a physically justified value, okay? So our main purpose, the primary purpose in doing the LDA plus U is to get the D states in the correct position so that their effect on the overall band structure becomes more correct. Okay. In the process of doing that, it turns out the band gap changes, as you would expect. And let me give you some numbers. If you do an LDA calculation for zinc oxide, you find a band gap of 0.9 EV. I'll remind you the experimental gap is 3.4 EV. LDA gives you 0.9. LDA plus U gives you 1.5. Okay, so the band gap has gone up, but by no means is it anywhere close to the experimental value yet, and it shouldn't be. Okay, so at that point, with the 1.5 band gap, that's the extent of what we do with LDA plus U. Then, in a separate procedure, okay, what we do is say, well, we now have two data points. Okay. Let's extrapolate. And that may seem simplistic, but we actually have some arguments. I mean, to give you a specific example.
If you're using the word extrapolate, what is it that you change?
Right. Yeah. So let's say we have a point defect, like an oxygen vacancy, that has a level within the band gap. Okay, and of course there is a rigorous definition for the transition level, which is actually a total energy difference. But for now, let's just think of it as a Cohn-Sham level. So you do a band structure calculation, you find that level, and we know that these point defect levels can essentially be expressed in terms of a superposition of a linear combination of valence band states and conduction band states. Okay, so the LDA result for this would give you that level at a specific position within the band gap, but the band gap is only 0.9 EV. So at that stage, you have no idea where that level is going to be if the band gap is 3.4 EV. Okay. But we have a second data point, namely in the LDA plus U calculation, that level is going to be in a somewhat different position when the band gap is 1.5 EV. And we think, well, we have arguments for justifying this, that the change between those two calculations, the effect it has on the defect level, really reflects the correct physics about the relative proportion of valence band and conduction band character contained in that defect level. And based on that information, we extrapolate.
Yeah, and then you need one more piece, which is the experimental.
Yes, and we just use the experimental band. We know where we want to get to in terms of the band gap, and that's what gives us the final result for the defect level.
This is properly defined scissor operator with results. Just project the valence production and the defect state.
If you manage to find a proper way of projecting out that valence and conduction band character, it would in principle do that. Yeah. We feel a little more comfortable about doing this actually because I think it has more of the physics in it. And we need to do this LDA plus U anyway because it's a separate problem. So it's
simpler to do it this way.
Pardon?
It's simpler to do it this way,
well,
because you have
yeah.
Numbers.
Yes.
Could you ever ask another question?
Sure.
If you might apply then this whole thing to calculate, say, the latency energy or some kind of ground state, like the latency on paper,
mm-hmm.
and
the other way around. The food bank structure can be to allow the surface energy and stuff like that.
Well, what we... I wish I'd brought more transparency on this, sorry about that. But let me try to express it in words. The procedure I was describing to you is an extrapolation for transition levels. If we actually then want to go back and make statements about energies, we have to make some assumptions, if you will, about how that shift in defect levels will affect the total energy. And there we make the following argument, which will sound simplistic to you, but we have thought about it very carefully, and we think it is actually justified. If that level we're talking about is unoccupied, there is no change in the total energy associated with it. If there are one or two electrons in that level, the main contribution to the change in the total energy will be due to the fact that that level shifts up. Okay. Now, there are other contributions to the total energy. I just had a discussion with Matthias about this last week. There are other contributions to the total energy. Clearly, it's not just that single term in the sum over the eigenvalues that affects the total energy. However, the other terms in the total energy turn out to largely cancel. I'll remind you that we are interested in formation energies. They are defined as differences between the system with a defect and the system without a defect. So whatever you do to correct the band structure will have effects on both of these systems, and a lot of these effects simply cancel, and the one effect that really in the end dominates everything is the fact that if you have a defect level that's occupied with electrons, if you push that up in energy, the overall total energy will go up. So that is the view of how we do these corrections. And I'll if I still have time, I'll give you a specific example of the zinc oxide, where we actually have a nice check where we can compare with experimental information, and everything seems to work out very well. Okay, so these are the results. As I said, we did this for all of the point defects. I won't be talking in any detail about them. What I'm showing here is for a specific choice of atomic chemical potential, so I'm focusing on zinc-rich material, which I will remind you is actually kind of the limiting case, the most optimal case for generating oxygen vacancies, if you're interested in their behavior. I'm showing you the formation energy of the defects as a function of the Fermi level, where zero Fermi level would be the top of the valence band. The maximum value of the Fermi level is at the bottom of the conduction band, so it spans the band gap. Okay, so zooming in on the behavior of the oxygen vacancy, I'm showing two lines with different slopes here. These slopes correspond to the charge state. For the 2 plus charge state, you have a linear dependence on Fermi level with a slope of plus 2. Okay, and really that's simply because those two electrons that were taken from the vacancy need to be placed at the Fermi level, and if the Fermi level is higher, that costs more energy, and that's why you have this increase. And then we would also do a calculation for other possible charge states. I'm only showing the formation energies for the lowest energy charge state for every Fermi level position. So once the Fermi level position goes above this level here, you get a horizontal line, meaning that the oxygen vacancy now prefers to be in a neutral charge state. So you already notice I go from 2 plus to neutral. The plus 1 charge state is skipped. That's interesting in its own right. It's a so-called negative U behavior. And two conclusions we can then immediately draw based on these values. First of all, the magnitude of this formation energy is large. Okay, as I said, this is the optimal case for generating oxygen vacancies. And they still have formation energies, at least under N-type conditions, the ones that the experimentalists are most interested in, formation energies close to 4 electrons, which means that for any sort of feasible growth temperature, the corresponding concentration of these oxygen vacancies would be very, very low. Okay, so first conclusion, not very likely that you're going to have any oxygen vacancies at all present in the material. Second conclusion, the transition level between the 2+ and the neutral charge state, which is essentially the donor level in the language of semiconductor physics, this would give us the ionization energy of the donor, which determines the likelihood that this donor will actually put electrons in the conduction band and contribute to n-type conductivity. The calculated value of that is at about 1 electron volt below the conduction band minimum.
That was the first ionization potential.
Well, it's actually a little difficult to talk about it that way. This is for this 2+ to neutral transition energy, okay, which is an unusual transition because the +1 state doesn't.
So that's for removing both electrons.
Yes. Yeah. We have detailed information about where the levels are for removing one for going from neutral to plus or from plus to double plus. But for the purposes of my argument, it doesn't actually change anything. The bottom line is that this level is very, very low below the conduction band, means a very, very high ionization energy, meaning that, again, at normal temperatures, this oxygen vacancy is not going to be ionized, okay? It's always going to be in its neutral charge state, so if it is present in the material, it will not act as a source of electrons, it will not act as a source of unintentional n-type doping.
Good question.
Sure.
From where the Fermi level is measured?
Top of the valence band, just a convention.
Top of the valence band.
Yeah, so zero is at the valence band maximum.
This itself will be determined by the doping.
The Fermi, so if you wanted to kind of close the loop, you would need to do something that's self-consistent. So here I'm showing you the formation energy as a function of a Fermi level. Okay, I've told you that once you have the formation energy, you can calculate a concentration. If you have a certain concentration of charge defects, then of course they will change the position of the Fermi level. So for a particular set of defects, plus any impurities that you want to include, you could go through a self-consistent procedure where you essentially determine all of these energies for any Fermi level position, and then you impose charge neutrality, and the charge neutrality condition will tell you where ultimately the Fermi level is. So basically, if all you had present in the material were these point defects, for this particular scenario, just by inspection we would know where the Fermi level is, because the oxygen vacancy acts as a donor, the zinc vacancy acts as an acceptor, their formation energies intersect here, so at this point they would have equal concentrations, which would give us charge neutrality, so the Fermi level would be down here. So again, not n-type material. So the common view that if you just grow ultra-pure zinc oxide, no impurities present, that the n-type conductivity that you get is due to oxygen vacancies, clearly, in our opinion, doesn't hold. The oxygen vacancy does not have the correct properties to be consistent with that. So,
where all these lines are depends on the chemical potential to kill growth, but otherwise that would change. So what is for zinc and oxygen the chemical potential in this plant?
Okay. The zinc chemical potential is fixed to the energy of bulk zinc, so that's the most zinc rich you can get. I made that choice because the more zinc rich you are, the higher the likelihood of generating oxygen vacancies. Okay, so since I specifically wanted to comment on oxygen vacancies, I thought, well, let's just give them all the benefit we can possibly give them by doing it for zinc-rich conditions. If you do this for oxygen-rich conditions, the red line for the oxygen vacancy, and actually for all of the donor defects, shifts up, and it shifts up by whatever the magnitude of the chemical potential is, and ultimately that range would be determined by the enthalpy of formation of the material. So, again, I really don't have time to go into this, but this negative U property that I was alluding to has a lot to do with the fact that for different charge states of our oxygen vacancy, we find very different relaxations of the surrounding zinc atoms. For the neutral charge state, there is a strong inward motion. In the plus charge state, there is a modest outward relaxation. In the double plus charge state, there is a huge outward relaxation. So very, very different atomic structures for different charge states. And that explains why you get this so-called negative U behavior. Normally, so by the way, the U I'm talking about here is entirely different from the LDA plus U that we talked about before. This U would simply have to do with the fact that if you go from 2 plus to plus to neutral, you add electrons to a defect level, and in the process of doing that, you would expect that because of Coulomb repulsion, the level would shift up. Negative U means that you get the opposite behavior, and the reason you get this opposite behavior is because the defect can actually lower its energy by having very different atomic structures in these different charge states. So, let me finish up with just doing this explicit comparison with experiment to that actually gave us quite a bit of confidence in our approach and helped us believe in what we were doing.
But the issue with the conclusion was that first of all, the oxygen vacancies don't form because the energy of formation is too high. And second, if you form, they are too deep to provide electrons to the conduction. So they are really immaterial for separating.
Yes. And luckily for us, the experiments by Vlasenko and Watkins established essentially those same two points. So George Watkins, of course, is probably the world's leading expert in doing electron spin resonance on point defects in materials. And he studied in great detail the behavior of the oxygen vacancy, which in the ESR experiment, they can very clearly identify. There is a distinct signature, ESR signature, associated with the oxygen vacancy, so they know very well. And by the way, that's not just George Watkins' work. That has been known for 20 years. People agree on what the signature in ESR of the oxygen vacancy is. Okay, so the first thing that Vlasenko and Watkins found was that if they took a piece of zinc oxide as received from a bulk crystal grower, and they looked for the oxygen vacancy, there were no oxygen vacancies present. Okay. When they irradiated the material and created point defects, then they saw the oxygen vacancy signal come up. But the as-grown material contained, I shouldn't say no oxygen vacancies, but oxygen vacancies in very small concentrations that did not show up in the experiment at all. So that's already entirely consistent with what I was saying. The oxygen vacancy has high formation energy, hence very low concentration. Then they proceeded to do optically detected ESR experiments. And it would take me another half hour to go into the details of how the experiment goes, but essentially what they can do is detect luminescent signals simultaneously with the ESR signals and essentially see which optical lines are associated with a particular point defect. Okay, And so this is one of the plots in their paper, which showed an emission band around 500 nanometers. And actually, in their paper, they acknowledged that this set specific limits on where the defect level had to be within the band gap, except that they didn't know whether that energy difference had to be measured with respect to the valence band or with respect to the conduction band. So based on our calculations, we were actually able to distinguish between those two possible scenarios, and on the left-hand side here, I'm drawing what the position of the defect level is. That's consistent, again this is from Watkins' paper, it's consistent with the emission energy here, and we're placing it at about 2.5 eV above the valence band, okay? And with that position, you essentially get the behavior of the optical emission for the oxygen vacancy that is observed experimentally, and that is completely consistent with the position of the defect level that we calculate with the approach that I was showing you.
So what is the ionization energy?
Well, the particular transition that they...
Because it is closer to the conduction.
No, actually this is 2.48 eV, so this is not very well to scale, but this would be 1 eV below the conduction band.
Yes, I see, because yeah. Micron is small, and peak is in the range of 1 micron.
Right.
So that's why it should be one. But that's for the excitation of the first electron. For ionization potential of the first electron. Yes?
So that's actually why we do these calculations for so-called configuration coordinate diagrams. So this again is a plot of the formation energy, but now as a function of the positions of the zinc atoms that surround the oxygen vacancy. So I told you that the energy of the oxygen vacancy changes a great deal depending on the positions of these oxygen vacancies and also depending on the charge state. So that's what these diagrams, which we can calculate explicitly, show, that for the 2 plus charge state we find a minimum over here, for the plus charge state it's over here, for the neutral it's over here. We didn't put quantitative numbers on here, we probably should have, but these are the different relaxations that I was telling you about.
For optical experiment, they ionize or transfer it to excited state, actually from S state to 2P state. What actually happens in the experiment? If they only excite the center, its charge state does not change. Of course, you say about a considerable polaron effect around it.
Actually, for this specific experiment, the charge state has to change because, as I mentioned, there is this direct link between the optical and the spin experiment. And in order to detect that, we actually do need to have different numbers of it. Yeah, right. And so that's why we actually have drawn in this arrow here to show that for the specific line that they see, our interpretation is that they go from the ground state of the neutral charge state to a plus charge state, which of course is not in its ground state. It will subsequently relax to its ground state, but that is the energy that you would actually observe,
and that
agrees with what they see experimentally. So I have a lot more slides, but we've been here for an hour. I will thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take any more questions, and thank you very much for coming. Not really. I'm aware there are lots of experiments. I see lots of controversial results. We haven't calculated manganese. I'm not going to speculate.
Thank you. question that it is unknown what kind of defect produces huge electron concentration.
Oh, well, if you want to hear the rest of my talk.
It is not oxygen vacancy.
It's not oxygen vacancies, it's not a point defect. We can exclude, some people have said zinc interstitials. We can exclude those as well for reasons that I could explain. But so, in our opinion, it's not point defects, it's impurities. Now, impurities, if you propose that as an explanation, many experimentalists are unhappy about that because everybody tries to grow the material under very pure conditions and likes to think that they don't have impurities. So I think in the case of zinc oxide, we actually have a compelling case for an impurity that most experimentalists would agree is almost impossible to exclude. Okay, and that impurity is hydrogen. This was very, very unexpected. I have done a lot of work on hydrogen in a lot of different materials. And what hydrogen, as we know, typically tends to do is it passivates things. Okay, if there is something already present that's electrically active, you put in hydrogen, the hydrogen goes in and it passivates that electrically active center. Actually, hydrogen, in a sense, passivates itself, not just through the formation of H2 molecules, but in the sense that hydrogen in a semiconductor or an insulator typically is amphoteric, meaning it can be either positively charged or negatively charged. It can be acting as a donor or it can be acting as an acceptor. And
as an interstitial or for substitution?
Actually, both. For simplicity, let's first think about interstitials, okay? And in materials like silicon or gallium arsenide or zinc selenide, this was already very well known theoretically, experimentally, that the hydrogen always reduces the conductivity of the material. Because when you introduce it into p-type material, it would behave as a donor and reduce the conductivity. If you introduce it into n-type material, it acts as an acceptor and it reduces the conductivity. So at first we thought that hydrogen and zinc oxide would behave the same way, and that all it would do would be to reduce the conductivity. By doing the calculations, we actually found that that's not what happens, that hydrogen and zinc oxide is exclusively a donor. You put it into the material, it always gives up an electron. In other words, it's ionization energy, its defect level is above the conduction band minimum. It can't keep an electron in there. That electron has to be given up to the conduction band of the material, so the hydrogen always acts as a source of electrons. And as I said, I think most people would agree that hydrogen is very, very difficult to avoid during the growth or the processing of a material. So if you have any hydrogen present, it will act as a source of n-type conductivity.
And what is the effective mass of electrons in zinc oxide? Is it known?
Estimate
the magnitude of the hydrogen-like ionization.
We have done that, and it becomes an effective mass theory problem, and so we have
from experiments.
People have done experiments in which they actually find that the hydrogen does behave as a shallow donor. They actually have done ESR and ENDOR experiments specifically identifying the hydrogen as the source of the donor, and with an effective mass ionization energy of, if I remember correctly, 60 millivolts, but I'm not entirely sure, but entirely consistent with the dielectric constant and the effective mass.
Is there a physical picture as to why it has to be a donor? Why it's so keen on being a donor?
Well, yes, but that's like another. I don't know whether I can quickly find the relevant transparency. Maybe I brought some more. Maybe I can quickly run through this little set of slides here. Okay, so as I was saying, hydrogen behaving as a shallow donor means that its defect level, its transition level, has to be above the conduction band minimum. And that's really surprising because in gallium nitride, for instance, very similar material otherwise, that level is somewhere in the middle of the band gap. Why are these two so different? Well, the reason is that the way I'm showing this picture, okay, is misleading because the band structure of gallium nitride and zinc oxide occurs in a very different energetic position on an absolute energy scale. If you want to express it as a band lineup problem, the valence band offset between gallium nitride and zinc oxide is about 1.5 eV. You take that into account, after proper alignment, you find that these levels occur at essentially the same energy. We found this very intriguing and was the basis for starting a broad investigation of the behavior of the level in a wide range of materials, and it actually is what we call a universal alignment. We've done like 30 different materials. Within a few tenths of an electron volt, the hydrogen level always occurs on the same scale on this absolute energy plot. Even in a material like silicon dioxide, band gap of 9 electron volts, always at the same level. Water, same level. Not a coincidence. We are very excited about this. We haven't had time to pursue it, but all of you have taken some chemistry course. Some of you many more than I have, I'm sure. You learn about electrochemistry, you learn about the standard hydrogen electrode, which has a potential that is essentially 4.5 eV below the vacuum level. I searched and searched and searched in chemistry and electrochemistry books and references for an explanation of why that level is at 4.5 eV below the vacuum level. I couldn't find anything. But that's where this picture shows it to be. And it comes out of essentially the same formalism that I was describing to you. We applied the same machinery to calculating the electronic behavior of hydrogen, in this case in water. If you want to think about it as ice, so that it's still a nice crystalline matrix, that's fine, but liquid water would give the same result. And this is the transition level between the positive and negative charge states of hydrogen. It's also a negative U impurity, interestingly. It's the transition level between plus and minus charge states in a water matrix. Yes?
Chris, in indium nitride, people also see N-type conductivity.
Yes.
Is it also the hydrogen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We published this before people actually had those results, but it immediately jumped out that the hydrogen level would be way above the conduction band minimum in indium nitride. That we proposed that as an explanation, and actually people here in the materials department, Professor Jim Speck and his students, are growing indium nitride. They're growing it with MBE, which nominally you would think wouldn't have any hydrogen. But they do SIMS experiments on their samples, and they found hydrogen concentrations between 10 to the 18th and 10 to the 19th per cubic centimeter. Nobody knows where the hydrogen comes from, but it's there, and it totally explains the observed N-type conductivity of indium nitride.
But then the puzzle is sort of why that's so universal, right?
Well, we also have an explanation for that. it doesn't have anything to do with hydrogen. I mean, clearly, if you think of the energies that the hydrogen atom has, well, it's 13.6 eV or 1 eV or whatever the ionization energies are. It's not 4.5 eV.
Yeah.
This is not anything to do with hydrogen. This is a charge neutrality level that is kind of a universal thing among these different materials, it essentially determines how these materials line up when you bring them together at an interface. And that's not something we invented. People have been talking about charge neutrality levels for 20 years as a way of identifying how two materials want to line up when you bring them together at an interface.
Some combination of universal constants that gives me 4.5.
Well,
that's how I understand it.
The argument about charge neutrality levels tells you that there should be a level that behaves this way. Why it is that 4.5 eV actually does not emerge directly from that argument, and we still don't know why it is exactly at 4.5 eV.
But if you use vacuum level alignment for the bandgap alignment for gallium and aluminum arsenide, it doesn't work. So what is the meaning of lining them up this way?
You're absolutely right. Zero is nominally the vacuum level, but is actually not directly relevant. What I've done in this plot is essentially line up materials with respect to one another. Okay, and we know that we can do that. So you could say, well, there are going to be
by the aluminum and gallium arsenide alignment doesn't look right.
This seems to be about 0.6 eV, which I think is consistent with the experimental value.
I thought the alignment should be 0.6 eV.
Gallium arsenide and aluminum arsenide. Oh, you're right. Something is funny here. The valence band offset seems
to be tricky because the indirect character of aluminum arsenide in your publication of low density.
I'll check this. Thanks for pointing it out.
In the convection band between gallium arsenide and aluminum,
right.
If you go from direct to indirect, if you go from direct to direct in gallium arsenide to aluminum arsenide, it's more. So you gallium arsenide is the direct gap you put, mm-hmm. Aluminum arsenide is the indirect gap. And then you have this difference of 0.4 electron volts.
Right, but this still seems too small, right?
Oh, but that's about, well, maybe. No, it's still too small.
Yeah, it's still, yeah. I'll check this. The comment I was going to make was that in principle, all of these offsets are interface dependent. Okay, now, most of the interface dependence is actually because of effects at polar interfaces, where you essentially have plus and minus charges that set up dipoles, and you can avoid those effects by looking at nonpolar interfaces. And the other effect is due to strain. If there is a lattice mismatch between the two materials, you get strain, and that shifts the band structures. And again, for purposes of a plot like this, you can actually extract all of that using deformation potentials. And what we're plotting here is a so-called natural lineup that would occur between two materials in their natural relaxed state. So that gets rid of all of the interface specific effects. Well, I shouldn't say it gets rid of all of the interface specific effects. There is always some small error in these. And it may turn out that actually what you're seeing here is kind of a reflection of that 0.1 or 0.2 eV error that is essentially unavoidable, and as far as I know, the experiments don't do any better than that either. So I still think that, the bottom line is that on a scale of almost 10 electron volts, you get this alignment to about 0.2 eV. Yes?
You made a comment earlier on about this ubiquitous N-type connectivity for oxides, but you only have zinc oxide on this particular graph. You looked at other oxides to see if this is the source.
Yes, and well, I should, before I forget, let me add the disclaimer. We are not saying that hydrogen is the only possible donor in oxides, okay? There are obviously, we don't think it's
point defects.
And even in other oxides, we think that the common assumption that point defects are the main source, at the very least, should be scrutinized much more carefully. But we think impurities should be looked at in more detail, and hydrogen is one of these impurities that we think people should look at, and what consequences does that have for oxides? Well, I've listed a number of these in this plot. So this is work in progress, okay? For a number of these materials, well, you see, we don't have the little red bars yet. So all I've done is taken lineups from the literature, which I don't quite know how good they are, but put them on this alignment picture to kind of give us an idea, okay? So here is zinc oxide, N-type. Indium oxide, close candidate for actually also having N-type conductivity due to hydrogen. Tin oxide, very strong candidate. Materials like hafnium oxide, zirconium oxide, which the silicon technology people are currently very interested in. No worries about hydrogen being N-type, however, worries about an asymmetry. In silicon dioxide, which I guess is no longer in this plot, the hydrogen level is actually totally symmetric, almost within the band gap, halfway between valence and conduction band. In these materials, the hydrogen level is actually much closer to the conduction band, and that worries me in terms of the ability of hydrogen to passivate both positively and negatively charged defects. So again, something we need to look at in more detail. Okay. Thank you.